Hello, it is May 20th, 2014. This is episode 420 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. Today's death, Malik Seeley, who died May 20th, 2000. Seeley was the son of one of Malcolm X's bodyguards. He was in fact named after Malcolm, or Malik Shabazz, his original name before he changed it. Seeley played college basketball for St. John's in 8 years in the NBA. His teams made the playoff 4 times. But never won a series. He was also an actor, including the role of Stacy Penton, the egotistical star in the Whoopi Goldberg film Eddie. He was driving home from his best friend's Kevin Garnett's 24th birthday celebration when a man named Suksangwana Fengsi, who was legally drunk and heading the wrong way down a Minnesota highway, hit him head on and killed him. Fengsi received 2 years prison time for vehicular manslaughter, and then, 5 years later, he received 2 more DUIs and was sentenced to 8 years in prison. He's due to be released in 2 years. Seeley was 30 years old. Garnett is now 38. Here in Athens, though, it is merely Tuesday. I'm Will Leach, and I think you're spending part of your day with me. We are getting close to World Cup time. I'm not going to do World Cup week yet, though I will be doing a full week of shows on the World Cup at some point. But today, I'm excited to have Dave Zirin. He's a sports editor of The Nation and author of the new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil. Before we get into the really breakdown of all the fun of the World Cup, we need to remember the ugliness of what happened to have Brazil have it here. People are kind of caught up in what's going on in Qatar and whether they should have the games there in 8 years, but it's been no picnic in Brazil either. And we're going to talk to Mr. Zirin about that right now. All right, Dave. First off, thanks for coming on with me. I want to know. I'm getting over my frustration that I blink and you've written another book.
Yeah.
As I talk to you, but seriously, thanks for coming on. I'm excited to chat with you about this.
No, I'm happy to talk to you too. I hope I can be on in a couple months when my next book about my love for the St. Louis Cardinals hits the stores.
You monster! You monster! You monster! Don't you dare! I literally have 8 upcoming books about that very topic.
I mean, it's just mine is different though because it's basically a critique of all the writing you've ever done about the Cardinals.
Oh no! Oh, crap. Well, you know what?
500 pages.
Okay, now I know I won't read it. I was kidding. I would read everything that you do, including this book, which Brazil's Dance with the Devil. About now, you when was the first idea? The time that you had the idea to do this? Because of course you went to Brazil and you like. Have you been fascinated with Brazil for a long time? Has this always been a country, or has this kind of melded into with everything that's been going on with the World Cup?
No, I mean it's a crazy story in that it started with just me saying, "Hey, Brazil is about to have the World Cup and the Olympics back to back. First time that's happened in 20 years, and 20 years ago when it happened, it was the United States, and it was very different because it was 94 World Cup and then 96 Atlanta Olympics. This is very different in that the epicenter for both is going to be Rio de Janeiro. And given that Brazil is such an emerging economy and has been on this taxicab meter growth rates over the last 10 years, and given the fact that I've been covering every World Cup and Olympics since about 2002 and seen what these mega events do to countries, I thought it would just be fascinating in and of itself. So I was like, yes, Brazil book. That makes a lot of sense. Time it for the World Cup. Bada bing, bada bang, bada boom. I'm paying college for my kids now. I'm not having to, you know, go to the homeschool university of Dave. So that's good. So
I would go to that school. For the record, I would go to that school.
It's not an accredited degree. Well, we party our asses off. But then I went down there and I was immediately profoundly humbled. Like this old professor who I sat down with, he said to me, Brazil is not for beginners. And that was then my starting point for everything. I mean, Brazil is a profoundly complicated country. It's bigger than the continental United States, 200 million people, incredible diversity of culture, of just the way people interact with each other city to city. And I was immediately just over the top intimidated that I could write this book because I was like, how do I even get my arms around something that people spend their whole lives studying and what would be the even use of that? So I almost ditched the idea entirely. And then in 2013, the protests exploded, the biggest protests in 30 years, all aimed around the Confederations Cup, people protesting the World Cup construction. And then I was looking at all my notes, all the interviews I did when I was down there, and it was like, holy shit, I have a book. I have direction. It's now the book is about why are Brazilians protesting soccer? And I want to explain that for a U.S. audience.
So, you know, obviously the World Cup has certainly wreaked some havoc in countries of the past. But what is it specifically about Brazil, and not only Brazil in general, but this specific time in Brazil that, mm-hmm. that's making this all kind of come to a head?
It's a great question. I mean, it's the biggest demonstrations in 30 years since the end of the dictatorship. And that's one of the things that's making it come to a head. I mean, first of all, in Brazil, you have what you've seen in every country where you've had the World Cup or the Olympics. For shorthand purposes, let's call them the three Ds, even if that sounds a little Darren Revellian to try to put it down like that. Like, I'm trying to brand the destruction in people's lives. But the three Ds are basically displacement, debt, and defense. So in all these countries where you've had, including the United States, when you have these mega events, you have people displaced from their homes, you have the cost of the events spiral frighteningly, and then you have particularly post 9/11, although it really starts in 96 after the Richard Jewell, the non-Richard Jewell bombing in Atlanta. God, that's such a tragedy to call it the Richard Jewell bombing, innocent man. But you have like the stepping up of defense, and you have just the incredible pressure on people's lives, like cameras everywhere, stop and frisk every block, and then a totally militarized police force going into people's homes, particularly in the poorest homes, and making people's lives hell. So you have that there like you've had in other places. I mean, the difference in Brazil is that Brazil is a relatively new democracy. It's only had a formal democracy for under 30 years. And there is this idea that with these games, Brazil was really coming into its own, that this was about being an international power, if not on par with, very close to the United States. It's already one of the five biggest economies on earth. And then all of a sudden, you have FIFA coming in and acting like they're the new dictator of Brazil, and working through the current government, the Workers' Party, to make people feel like they lost any sort of democratic control over their lives. And that hits a particularly sensitive spot for a country that felt like it was promised one particular bill of goods about what this tournament would bring, and then find themselves, I mean, really being immiserated. And so it started with just a raise in bus fares in Sao Paulo, something as small as that. And then the World Cup just then became this thing that crystallized. So all across the country, it became the focus for people's discontent with healthcare, with education, with public spending. And it's such a remarkable thing. It would be like, imagine in the United States if people in Brooklyn were protesting for the same things that people in Tuscaloosa were protesting for. And that's what you're getting now in Brazil.
Now, how much of this is FIFA directly doing this, and how much of it is frustrations in the country funneling in to what's going on with the World Cup?
Well, it's interesting because FIFA, as a friend of mine just emailed me from Brazil, FIFA is about as popular a name in Brazil right now as FEMA was in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina.
That's very unpopular.
Yes, very, very unpopular. So people put a lot of it on FIFA because they see FIFA as being the change. They say, okay, FIFA is coming in. They're saying they want, this is the phrase they use, FIFA quality stadiums, FIFA quality infrastructure. And that's fed a lot of the slogans of the movement. Like, we want FIFA quality hospitals. We want FIFA quality schools. I mean, the security guards around one of the stadiums just went on strike and they said, we want FIFA quality wages. So it's becoming this catch-all phrase to express a set of priorities in government that they profoundly disagree with. But what's so interesting is that so much of what the government is doing right now, they would be doing anyway.
Right.
The presence of the World Cup just makes it a lot easier. And just give one example of that is that Rio has been undergoing a real estate speculation boom. I mean, the sort of thing that would make San Francisco blush. I mean, just the housing prices through the roof. Brazil also has some of the toughest squatter rights laws in the world. So you have people who've built these makeshift communities called favelas on the hills throughout Rio. The government has been trying to get people out of their homes so they can develop on that property for years. And so that's the government's doing. FIFA isn't like, we want you to develop real estate on the hills of, I mean, they don't care about that. But it's something that the government has then been able to use as a pretext for going in there and clearing people out. So it's this very complicated, but at the same time, not very complicated dance that's taking place with FIFA and the Brazilian government. Unfortunately, this dance, I mean, they're trampling on masses of people in Brazil.
Now, which is worse, what FIFA has, like what's going on with the World Cup or the Olympics? Because it feels like that, like it seems like they're so, like the Olympics have their own issues of being behind and safety issues with the construction. Which is ultimately, is FIFA just the warm-up act, or are the Olympics going to be tougher for them?
Man, I'm answering every question you ask me with, wow, that's a great question.
I'm a reporter.
But it really is a great question because you know why that's such a great question, Will, is that when I went down there and I spoke to a lot of people who were parts of social movements, unions, politics. And what they all said was that there would not be protests before the World Cup, but they expected big protests before the Olympics. And they're like, ah, people love soccer, but you know the Olympics, you know, when there's so much construction that has nothing to do with anything anybody really cares about, that's when you're going to see people get really upset. All those folks were wrong. Why were they wrong? What they weren't realizing or taking account of is that the Olympics is going to be an entirely Rio-centric event, like all about Rio, all in Rio. And the fact that the World Cup is spread out dramatically, I mean, I have a map at the start of the book so people can see it. Like everywhere where there's going to be a World Cup, there's going to be stadium construction. And everywhere there's stadium construction, there are favela occupations because they're worried about security. And so what the World Cup did is it nationalized the discontent and acted as almost like a connector belt between different cities that otherwise would have nothing to say to each other, who all of a sudden had this common foe symbolized by the growth of these stadiums or white elephants, as they're called.
So now there were just protests last week, I believe, on Thursday. I think there was another kind of round, I think in Sao Paulo, I think were the largest ones. Is anything galvanizing? Is anything kind of coming together, or is it just kind of a, are they, this isn't Russia. I don't think there's been a ton of people thrown in jail from these protests, but certainly is it affecting any change, or has there been any response or anything?
There's a lot of carrots and a lot of sticks being dangled about. I mean, the government is working at a rapid pace, I'm sorry, throwing carrots and sticks all over the place. I mean, some of the carrots, for example, is that there's a big occupation by the landless peasants movement, which is happening right next to the opening round game stadium. Like the first game is going to be played in Sao Paulo, and right next to it, 10,000 people occupying this area of land. And the government is already trying to figure out, it's like, okay, can we make a deal with these folks to leave and we'll build some permanent low-income housing on this empty plot of land next to the stadium? So while the government is trying to think of things like that to do, at the same time, they're also trying to pass a law that says that any presence at a demonstration would be akin to an act of terrorism. I mean, that's the level of extremism. So even like peaceful demonstrations during the World Cup could be seen as violating an anti-terror law. And so it's like these they and they're doing other things too, like they're getting drones put together to fly overhead so they can do surveillance. They're militarizing the police force so it's centralized and orders for what the police do go out from Brasilia, the capital of the country. So a lot of carrots, a lot of sticks. And nowhere do you see this more than in the favelas themselves, where there's been these huge resistance movements against getting moved out. So what the government has done in some of these areas is they've stepped up the amount of money they're paying people to relocate and trying to turn this into a feel-good story, like, oh, we're giving them all this money so they can move somewhere else. But then there's still people still resisting, and the people who are resisting the money, I mean, it's almost like a mafia situation. You know, it's like you resist the money and then you're actually in more trouble after that. I was trying to think of like the appropriate mob movie that even goes like where Where the guy's
Right.
like, first he offers him $300,000, then he's like, now I'll give you $3.
Yeah, it's a nice establishment you have here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it, that
Exactly.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is, we are 3 weeks, almost just a little over 3 weeks away from the actual start of these games. So, I mean, they're happening. You know, I mean,
Yes.
like, you know, there's no, there's really at this point, there's, I mean, hopefully everything will be ready, but they are happening. So, I guess my question is there for people like you who have covered this and have seen what this is kind of doing to Brazil and how and everything that you've been talking about in here and that you talk about in your book, it's happening now. So is there a best case scenario for getting more light shined on what's happening for this to maybe be a little easier? Like what can happen in the next 3 weeks or even I guess the next month and 3 weeks when once the games get going to kind of show this or maybe make this go as easily as possible.
Yeah, and that's really the question. I mean, because one of the slogans of the demonstrators is there will not be a World Cup. Well, there is going to be a World Cup.
It's happening.
It's happening. It's a great slogan. It gets a lot of attention, but the cup is going to go on as planned. The best thing that could happen would be, I think this is one of those situations where sunlight is the best disinfectant. If there is as much attention as possible paid on what is happening to people in Brazil, particularly with the displacements, then there's, I think, much less of a chance that the displacements will be as bad as they could be. I mean, one of the things, and this is, I write about this in the book, is that Brazil historically has, particularly the elites in Brazil, have always had a very, very hyper concern, unlike, say, I don't know, the Russians, about how the rest of the world sees them. I mean, you saw, like, Putin could not give a flying fuck, like whether or not, reporters were upset that they were getting, like, their emails hacked into, and what people bullwhipping people on the streets. I mean, there was like a real, Putin was really like, if you don't like it,
Yeah.
go to hell. That's
It
just
builds
not,
his brand, man.
yeah, it builds his brand. It's like, take off the shirts, get on the horse. I mean, Brazil is very much at the elite level, the opposite of that. Like, they want the invitation onto the UN Security Council. They want to be recognized as the economic power that they are. They want to be really a balancing force to the United States in the Western Hemisphere. And the idea of pulling off an event like this and an event like the Olympics is very much, I mean, from the very beginning, like when they won these bids, it was coached in those terms. Like, we are doing this because we want the rest of the world to see Brazil in a certain light. And what's so interesting about that is there was never any rhetoric from the elites in Brazil about how Brazilians might see themselves or what they might get out of it. It's always the image is projected outward. It's an image for export. It's Brazil. It's the movie Rio. It's Disney. It's all of that. And they want to project out the friendliest possible image that they possibly can. And you know what? They are going to fail at that if they don't pay more attention to the sort of things people are saying on the ground in Brazil. So that's the best case scenario, is that the many, and when I say many, I mean thousands of citizen journalists who've emerged over the last couple of years to tell the story what's happening, if they get as much attention as possible.
You bring up Putin, and it's funny because I remember being out there, because I was in Sochi this year, and being out there, being so first off so nervous when I got out there. I mean, people forget now that like a guy from the Defense Department went on Meet the Press and said I wouldn't let my family go there. I mean, like people kind of forget
Like,
that like
thanks.
yeah, seriously, yeah. My wife loved that. So she was very excited about that. And so but when that happened, it's funny because the goal, Putin, one of the things that he wanted to do for all of his, not give a shitness, he still, like you kind of put it about Brazil, he wanted Russia to be seen a certain way. That was one of the reasons he did the Olympics. That was one of the reasons he spent so much money on it. And he wanted them to be seen as this place that could host these global games and be part of the thing. And frankly, he, all told, if Ukraine doesn't explode at the end of those games, he probably pulls it off. Like in a surface level sense, in a okay, games went over without any explosions, Putin must be doing something right, and everyone moves on with their day because that's kind of how things are covered anymore. And so I'm curious about that. Is there a benefit to Brazil if everything gets done in time and everything runs? I guess my question there is there a way for all the foreign journalists that are coming in to report on this, is there, if everything runs smoothly, are they just going to gloss over protests like this? Is there a way to get that out? Or if this goes smoothly, are people just kind of gloss over the way that I think they would have, they kind of ultimately did gloss over stuff in Sochi until, of course, Ukraine kind of exploded.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we all saw what happened in Sochi. I mean, Sochi is this very isolated resort community where Putin effectively created a Potemkin village. And with Cossacks roaming the streets and whatnot. And so the very openings for protests were only probably slightly more amenable than the Beijing Olympics. Actually, they were probably worse than Beijing. And I knew some folks who tried to do like some Tibet protests in Beijing, and it was literally like people dropping from the roofs, rappelling down and throwing them in trucks. And it's like we were out there for what, 3.2 seconds? Okay, great.
it's like riding a bull.
Yeah, seriously. And the thing about Brazil that makes this difference is, A, it's the World Cup, so it's national. So it's not like they can focus on one city like, say, a Sochi or even a Beijing. And B, I mean, people in Brazil, I mean, they are in a fighting mood. And that's I think, a very different set of equations. Like, you think about all the articles we saw, not just coming out of Sochi, but out of Russia as a whole about LGBT rights. I mean, they were less about movements and more about the tragic stories of people living under tremendous repression. Like that was much more the picture of what was happening there. I mean, in Brazil, it's about people sort of like a whole generation really sort of finding their footing and trying to think about what kind of priorities they want for Brazil to be, because Brazil has had all of this spectacular economic growth, and in many areas it has also reduced inequality. But the quality of education is still terrible. The quality of healthcare is terrible. And they view the fact that this is the most expensive World Cup in history. I mean, low estimate, $15 billion. It's like this, they said, this is our time. And I think with the media, it's like when you give them something to cover, that's when they really are, frankly, at their best. In other words, when the people do their job for them, they're at their best. And they just have to go out and point and shoot and see what's there. And, you know, like the old expression, better at covering revolution than evolution. This is one of those examples, is that I'm not saying there's going to be a full-scale revolution, but you are going to have the sight of Brazilians protesting soccer. Right. And that's a hell of a narrative. That would be like if we did the mass protests in Brooklyn against pizza. I mean, it has that kind of like, okay, something is happening here that we need to pay attention to and try to understand. And that's when you get into big discussions about FIFA, about the promises of the Brazilian government and how they've come up short, and about this young generation of Brazilians who are really coming into their own.
Well, I think there's a chance that the foreign media will cover that if they get there and their hotel rooms are okay. Yes. I think that if they're not distracted by their doorknobs not working – maybe they'll go out and do
There's no toilet paper.
My God. My favorite thing was when people were mad in Russia about you not being able to put the toilet paper in the toilet. Like, you're not supposed to do that anywhere in Europe. Like, that's kind of how it works. Like, anyway.
My favorite was just like the language. Like I thought I knew horror when I read about the Bataan Death March.
But no, there's only one towel.
Yeah, there's one towel. My God. Now I know how Mandela must have felt.
It worked, though, man. Like, to this day, the number one question that people ask me about my time in Sochi was, seriously, your hotel, like, what was it like? It's like, I was halfway across the world. When, like, at the Olympic Games, and people want to know if my doorknob worked. So
we think that Putin is so clever and Machiavellian that this was a strategy.
I mean, honestly, like, I'll put it this way. If they did enough pre-existing research to know that all sports writers really want to do is complain about the accommodations, maybe they deserve the positive coverage that they got, because I guess that's not that hard to find out. I guess my last question about this is, I mean, listen, I'm excited about the World Cup. You're excited about the World Cup. This is a really fun sporting event that is this rare kind of, like, I know that when it comes to the Olympics and the World Cup and everything, I know that for these things to happen, a lot, and I think it's probably more extreme, I think, in both the Sochi Olympics and these games, that there's a certain kind of everyone, I think, has to, if not accept, at least be aware of and understand that there is a lot of ugliness that goes into these games. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to enjoy them while they're going on. I think it's the opposite, as a matter of fact. And I think a lot of times that allows these games to get away with a lot. I guess my question for you is this: is someone like me, or someone listening to this, who is like, man, he's totally right. This is, everything he's written about in this book is correct, and they're pushing them down, and it's going to get worse than the Olympics, and this is such a mess going on. But I also want to enjoy the World Cup. Is there anything that we can do? Is there a call to action, other than buying your book, which I recommend everybody do? Is there a call to action that just as schlumpy Americans listening to this podcast can, is it something to be aware of? Is there something that you'd recommend they do both during this World Cup and afterwards to maybe help some of the things that you're writing about?
Yeah, and I really appreciate you asking that, because there will likely be a call on the first day of the World Cup for people to go to the Brazilian consulate, if you live in a city where there is one, to show solidarity at the Brazilian consulate. And that, why is that important? It's important because the folks who go out into the streets in Brazil on that first day, they're going to get shot and they're going to get gassed. And I promise you, if Brazil feels like the whole world is watching, it will limit their uses of force. It's pretty as simple as that. So if folks can, get out of the house, take the 20-minute trip or whatever it is to the consulate and stand around for an hour, it actually would make probably a difference in the lives of some people you've never met before. So I'm just putting that out there,
Okay.
not trying to guilt anybody into doing
Of
it.
course, I understand.
No, but just, you did ask, and that's
No.
the most honest answer about what people can do. Now, about the cup itself, and I mean, I fully respect if people think that I'm absolutely just fooling myself or trying to justify the fact that I love the World Cup and love sports and all the rest of it. But I really think that for people who want to have some credibility in terms of the protests in Brazil, you also should know what's happening on the field itself and try to enjoy it and try to understand why exactly it is that so many hundreds of millions of people are passionate about this tournament. I think if you watch, you'll get sucked in, particularly if you choose a team to learn something about and to follow all the way through. And I really do believe this, that if you get sucked into the spectacle, to the excitement, to the athleticism, to the joy of it, then you are better able to talk about the ways in which events like the World Cup and the Olympics can plausibly change.
Dave, one of the many reasons I love your stuff, for the many reasons I enjoy talking to you now, I'm always reminded, like even I've always struggled with this, and you and I have known each other for years, and I've always
Yes.
struggled with this kind of idea of only wanting to know so much how the sausage is made, and only because I love sports. Because I love sports, and this is something that's really important to me, and one of the reasons I love sports is because it allows me some, like, I can sit down at a baseball game or a basketball game or a football game or a soccer game with someone with whom I disagree with on every possible matter on earth. And if they are a fan of the team that I'm rooting for, do you realize how many Americans I disagree with I'm going to be rooting for, rooting with during the World Cup? Like, that's one of the things I love about sports. But on the other hand, I find it, I find it increasingly difficult to keep my head in the sand about stuff. And one of the many things I enjoy about you, Dave, and this is another reason why everyone should buy the book, is you love sports. And I know that sounds like a silly thing to say to a sports writer, but first off, you'd be amazed how many sports writers don't love sports. But
I know, right?
it's
I'm not going to
crazy.
say who. I was just talking to a very famous dude, and I don't even want to say his name because it's embarrassing. But he asked me, like, how I'm doing, and I said, oh, I'm really psyched about the Wizards playoff run. And he just looked at me and he said, I don't trust fans.
Yeah, I mean,
and I'm like, fuck you.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. And so, yeah, so and that's a kind of a side point, but like that's almost another discussion of how much sports writers don't like sports. But I find even when a lot of times with people that are pointing out how a lot of the how much ugliness has to come together for us to enjoy these games, I often find a humorlessness about them, and I wonder if they actually like the games. I never have that from you, Dave, and I feel like that is one of the best ways, frankly, for you to get your points across, is because you're another fan like me and like everybody else, and it makes me enjoy your stuff that more, and it makes me listen, frankly, a lot closer to what you're saying and read your stuff. So thank you for being a fan on this, even if the Wizards, for the record, if you're going to change the world, man, change the Wizards.
Everything that's small and evil and dark about this world, which is
not to talk in terms of hyperbole, but I just, but I mean, if basketball is the ultimate expression of athletic joy, which I actually really do believe, then the Pacers really do represent the negation of that joy. And so that's very, very hard thing for me to take in, especially when I still have visions of John Wall dancing through my head. So,
I'm curious. What do you are you going to have a spot where you watch the World Cup? Are you going to? I mean, I know where you'll be the first day, but I mean, do you know where? Do you have an idea of? Do you have a spot? Do you have a pub? Do you have a local?
Yeah, I mean, the first day I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in Brazil for a good part of June. We got the book We found a Brazilian publisher, so it's going to be published in Portuguese down there. And so I'm going to do some events with them and really be just reporting from what I'm seeing.
Oh,
I'm going to go to the
demonstrations
down there and, you know, try to be as safe as possible, but also do my job, which is get up there and see what's happening. So that'll be a lot of June. And then when I come back, I'm actually going to be traveling a lot with the book. So I'm going to be watching the game in a lot of cities and doing some events where we watch the World Cup. I'm going to be at a place in Brooklyn. I bet you know this place, the Commons.
Of course.
I'll be there July 2nd, and so we'll watch some World Cup, and then we'll talk some World Cup. So hopefully that could act as a bridge to not just talk to politicos who are into soccer, but also just straight-up soccer fans who are just curious about what's happening.
This is my last question, actually. One of the things that I've written about this before, about how I find that U.S. soccer fans are I joke that it's hipster patriotism.
Yeah.
And then in a lot of ways that, like, it's like this, people that would not ordinarily be flag waving, you know, don't tread on me people, like, getting inspired. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, there's a difference. It's almost a Portland patriotism, if you will, in a lot of ways. Do you see that from that fans? And do you, when you watch U.S. soccer and look at the U.S. soccer team, I find myself feeling different about cheering for the U.S. soccer team than I do, say, cheering for the U.S. basketball team?
No, and I've heard that from folks before, too, is that they like rooting for U.S. soccer because it's the one time you get to feel like the underdog country.
Yeah, it's the one way. It's the one time we are the way we pretend we are the rest of the time.
and like the idea of the United States as scrappy upstarts,
right?
In many walks of international life,
but we totally that's totally part of the American character. We imagine ourselves I think almost always to our national detriment. But we imagine ourselves we just fight harder and we work harder and we're not as talented, but doggone it, we fight harder. And it's funny to me because it feels like the people that don't like soccer. Would if we could just sell the team to them that way, which is actually closer to the truth than they are in any other sports, I feel like we could actually get them into it, because I feel like it is the one time that our illusion of ourselves actually has a little bit of validity.
And it's so interesting too, and I've written about this before, but like when you every soccer season, every World Cup season, you get the same critiques from kind of the Glenn Beck crowd.
Right.
About it being anti-American and about it being even like it, like National Review had this big thing about it being a socialist sport that rewards mediocrity. And you're just like, what game are you watching to even say something? But it's just whatever they want it to be is what it is. And unfortunately, I think that has a pull among some people. But I also think, like, what's so interesting, you asked me about where – I mean, I'd love to tell you where I would watch it if I was here in D.C. Where I watched it last time is this place called the Ghana Cafe in Adams Morgan. And that's the other thing I love about the World Cup too, is like that, especially if you live in a city like DC, it's like if the African, if a team from Africa is going on a run, you go to the African bar and you get to watch with everybody. If a team from Latin America is on the run, you know, you go to that bar and you watch with people, and the energy is just off the chain. And it's just so much fun to see, to actually match up the local immigrant population in your community with the game itself. Particularly because, and maybe this is just my experience, but I have found that when you go into those bar spaces, people aren't like, you know, get out of here, you know, you gringo or whatever. You know, it's like people are like, family, you're here with us. This is awesome. Like, this time to really feel like, hey, eat something, drink something. And then it's like every bar becomes like a stereotypical Irish pub, no matter what nationality. Is the one on the door. So that's, I mean, that's just another thing I love about the World Cup. In a weird way, this most hyper nationalist of undertakings also breeds a kind of internationalism as people try to let other people in and enjoy what they're enjoying.
Oh, you're totally right. You just made me miss New York so much more than any point I have since I left. You're exactly right. That's like one of the best parts about the World Cup. It was great in 2010 and great in 2006 was great because they all came at like 2002 is my favorite because all the games were at like 3 a.m.
Oh man!
So like, I remember I was with AJ DeLorio one night getting very drunk at a bar. I mean, we'd forgotten the World Cup was on because we were very drunk, and all of a sudden like people showed up at like 2:30, like rushed to the bar. We're like, oh right! And then it left like the next 2 hours to be great. I love that about the World Cup, and you're exactly right. That is one of the best parts about it. Dave, thank you for coming on with me. The book is Brazil's Dance with the Devil. This is everywhere. I can get this on Amazon and other and your site and other booksellers now, correct?
Yep, all the typical spots.
Okay, good. All right, well, congratulations. Safe travels, man, and it was a pleasure talking to you, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Will. Be well, man.
Be safe. All right, thank you to Dave Zirin. You can follow him on Twitter at Edge of Sports, EdgeOfSports, and you can get the book Brazil's Dance with the Devil on Amazon right now, this very second, and also in several seconds from now and several seconds ago. It's just all over the place. It's out there now. It's on the grid. You can't hide from it. Anyway, this has been the Release Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Wednesday's guest, an old friend of mine, Sir Patrick Stewart, star of the upcoming film X-Men Days of Future Past. We're going to talk Brooklyn and soccer. Are those the same thing anymore? They might be. Anyway, yeah, Patrick Stewart tomorrow. That'll be fun. I'll talk to him and you then.